Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There are drugs on the program today, both prescription and over-the-counter. Foreclosures as well. A dip down to Rio and out to rural Georgia, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, May the 6th today. Good to have you with us. And we will begin with a divestment of sorts, a trimming of assets to get down to core competencies. In return for a cool $14.2 billion, the pharmaceutical behemoth Merck announced today it's going to offload its consumer care division to Bayer. That's brands like Dr. Scholl's and Coppertone, Claritin, and Afrin. Sinuses are big, I guess. Merck says it's going to focus on its prescription drug business from now on. So we asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to spend a couple of minutes explaining why Merck is so over-the-counter.
All drugs are not created equal. There are the pills and creams you buy off the shelf and the stuff you have to get your doctor to prescribe. And those businesses have almost nothing in common, says Les Funtleiter, author of Healthcare Investing.
Oh, yeah, they are very different. I mean, one is bulk manufacturing, one is heavy-duty R&D.
That heavy-duty research and development? $5 billion. That's how much it costs to get a single prescription drug to market these days. Why would Merck want to focus on that business?
The return on investment is much higher in the prescription market.
J.B. Silvers is a professor of health finance at Case Western Reserve University. He says Merck is well-positioned with a strong pipeline of cancer and diabetes drugs.
If you can do well there with patented drugs that have protection against competition, you can pretty much charge what you want.
Not so in the world of allergy pills and arch support, says Silvers. The consumer drug market is all about competitive pricing and catchy advertising.
You gelling?
I'm gelling like a felon.
Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles is so...
It's a volume market. It's like most retail. You have a smaller margin, but if you sell a whole lot of it, you can do really well with that.
And that's what Bayer does best, says Dan Mendelson, CEO of Avalir Health.
Bayer is going to be able to leverage their global reach to take these products to places where they haven't been sold before.
Mendelson says when it comes to branding, marketing, and selling things like sunscreen and nasal spray, Bayer simply has a better machine. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The White House was out today with its latest national climate assessment, the Obama administration's take on what a changing climate is doing to this country and what's going to happen if we don't figure something out. Which means, since it's the Obama administration's report, the guy whose name is on it is going to be out the next couple of days promoting it. He'll be spending time with weather forecasters, eight of them across the country, from NBC's Al Roker to maybe the person on your local news. Which kind of makes sense, stands to reason, right? But not, as Dan Bobkoff reports, for the reason you might think.
Many Americans trust their local weathermen for the five-day forecast. How about for the truly long range?
New at 5, what will the Southern California climate be like in 30 years?
Ed Maybach heads George Mason University's Center for Climate Change Communication. He says Obama is smart to use weather people to promote the national climate assessment.
Unlike climate scientists, they already have the eyes and the ears of the American people.
But Maybach says many meteorologists are climate skeptics.
While almost all of them understand that the climate is changing, they're not all necessarily convinced that human activity is driving the change.
And some don't even go that far. Among the most prominent of the unpersuaded, Joe Bastardi, chief meteorologist.
A meteorologist, not an Al Roker journalist.
That's meteorologist at weatherbell.com. His take on climate change.
The weather was far worse in this country in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. In the end, I think this is much ado about nothing. I think it'll wind up on the ash heap of history.
According to Maybach's research, a full quarter of TV weather people said they don't believe climate change is happening in the most recent survey in 2010. About an equal number said they weren't sure. The head of the American Meteorological Society, Keith Sider, says some may be skeptical because they see how often their computer models don't produce accurate short-term forecasts.
They translate some of that into
having some concerns about using the similar kinds of models to project the climate out for many, many years.
For the record, the AMS supports the president's report. Obama is now trying to get more TV weather people who believe the long-range forecast to spread the word. I'm Dan Popkoff for Marketplace.
Two observations about Wall Street today before we get to that thing I always say right about here on the broadcast. This was the fourth anniversary of the nerve-wracking flash crash of 2010 when the Dow dropped 1,000 points in just a couple of heartbeats. That did not happen today. But should you happen to be looking for a loser in the markets on this Tuesday, Twitter would be a real good place to start. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're a mere 37 days from the start of the 2014 World Cup, or as they say in the host nation of Brazil, Copa do Mundo. Just 2 years after that, it'll be the 2016 Summer Olympics, and as is now becoming ritual for these two big events, Brazil is getting a whole lot of criticism for how far behind it is in its preparations, both from Brazilians and from outside observers as well. The BBC's Wera Davies is in Rio. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
Is it too early? Is it unfair to say that perhaps Brazil has already lost the World Cup and the Olympics the way the press is going?
The news is really bad in recent days and recent weeks, a lot worse than I thought it would be at this stage. Of course, Brazil always does things at the last minute. And the fact that Brazil has been so late is something that perhaps could be predicted. I think what couldn't be predicted was this perfect storm. We've got a lot of Brazilians who, of course, are soccer mad, are really unhappy with the World Cup, and they've been out on the streets protesting.
Tell me what it looks like when you go around and you try to see the stadiums and the infrastructure that's built. I mean, we hear every couple of years, we hear, oh, this is the worst Olympics ever and nobody's ever prepared, and yet somehow it all comes off. Do you think, even with the amount of money that's being spent, that they're going to get it done?
The World Cup will happen because what they will do, what they are doing right now, is focusing on getting the 12 stadiums ready. Six of these stadiums, the new ones, missed the end-of-year deadline to be ready by the end of 2013. The one in São Paulo, Brazil's biggest city, where the opening game will take place on June the 12th, still isn't ready. I'm sure it will be in terms of the pitch. You know, the 22 guys will be out there kicking a bag of wind around the place. The problem is that everything else isn't ready. All of the promised infrastructure. I mean, this was meant to be an integrated World Cup that was good for the entire country. All of the integrated transport, all of the other benefits, you know, the legacy for Brazil. And I've been speaking to people like Christopher Gaffney, who's a visiting professor at university here in Rio, and he says the whole thing is a wasted opportunity.
We've concentrated on the wrong projects. We've overbuilt in all these ways. And so in the end, it's going to be a big party, but Brazilians will have a hangover for the next generation.
Well, along those lines, then, Brazilians like a good party. Are they angry that this money is being spent? I mean, favelas are being destroyed. The price of a cappuccino is through the roof, you know.
That's what I say. It's a perfect storm. It's not just the one thing. You know, Brazilians are putting up with a difficult economic situation. It's very expensive here. The economy's slowed down. I mean, some things aren't that bad. Most people who want a job have got a job. This government has done a lot of good things. The problem is the Brazilian government is spending $15 billion on this World Cup. And a lot of people are saying, well, hang on, what do we get out of this? You know, OK, Brazil might win the tournament, which is good news for us as soccer fans. But where's everything else that was promised?
Do you have tickets to the match on the 12th of June yourself?
I'll be there. But as I'm a news journalist, I'll probably be outside the ground, you know, covering some of the anticipated protests, the demonstrations, rather than sadly inside the ground, as much as I do like my soccer myself.
We're at Davis for the BBC. We got him in Rio, down in Brazil. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
We've been doing some reporting the past couple of weeks about home foreclosures and how, frankly, they're still happening 5.5 years after the financial crisis started. Today, though, a story about what happens after foreclosure, because if you think once they take the keys away, that's it, not so fast. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
In 2005, Miranda Cisneros Bell and her husband Ed bought their dream house for $535,000 in Emmitsburg, Maryland, about 2 hours north of Washington. They put 20% down and got a jumbo loan for the rest. Cisneros Bell says they were nervous. What if they couldn't sell their old house? She says the realtor said, "Don't worry."
It was a basic push to get us in a house. That was the trend of the times, was to push people into buying things that probably they couldn't afford.
Their old house didn't sell. In fact, that's where they live now, with Cisneros Bell's mother.
That's not fair. Wow.
They moved back in the fall of 2008. They couldn't make payments on their dream house and lost it to foreclosure in 2009. Then the letters started coming, not from her bank, but from a debt collector. Cisneros Bell's reaction?
It's impossible. I don't know who you are. You weren't part of my foreclosure. So basically, who are you?
The debt collector, Dick O'Neill Incorporated, says it bought her debt. But Cisneros Bell says she has no proof of that and is fighting Dick O'Neill in court. Dick O'Neill wouldn't comment on her case. Cisneros Bell's story is not unique. Many homeowners don't realize that lenders or debt collectors can pursue them if their house sold for less than they owe. So if you borrow $200,000 and your house sold in foreclosure for only $100,000, years later, the bank can say, "Hey, pay me back that $100,000. Confused homeowners are packing foreclosure workshops like this one in suburban Maryland, staffed by attorneys trying to answer the what next question. Attorneys like Avi Malik with Civil Justice, an advocacy group for homeowners.
The best thing you're doing is you're making sure you have records of everything.
Yeah.
What's going to happen is...
Later, Malik tells me some states have been shortening the time banks have to claw back what's still owed after a foreclosure. And the states hit hardest by the housing crisis are cutting back the most.
Florida recently changed the law for pursuing a deficiency judgment from 5 years to 1 year.
Maryland just shortened the time its bankers have to decide to pursue a homeowner from 12 years to 3. But banks in these states argue people took out these loans, promising to pay them back. Kathleen Murphy heads the Maryland Bankers Association. She says banks have a right to get their money back.
We are depository institutions. We're insured by the FDIC. We're lending our depositors money. And we have to be able to have a reasonable expectation that we're going to be repaid.
I absolutely understand where the banks are coming from.
That's attorney Avi Malik again. He says banks should be able to try to claw back their money, but not forever.
All we're doing with the deficiencies is we're trying to provide some finality with the statute of limitations and ensuring that it's a level playing field for people that are trying to rebuild their lives.
Especially, Malik says, since the playing field wasn't level for many homeowners during the housing bubble and crisis. For example, Miranda Cisneros Bell, the homeowner we met at the beginning of this story, both the U.S. Justice Department and Maryland Attorney General's office say her foreclosure was defective. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I thought I was going to, you know, escape the system by committing petty theft from large big box retailers.
Oh, but it got so much better. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, it was ugly out there, y'all. The Dow Industrial is off 0.75%, 129 points, closed at 16,401. The NASDAQ down 1.33%, 57 points, finished at 4,080. The S&P 500 reversed 0.9%, 16 points, closed at 1867. Now, let's talk about Twitter. The so-called lockup period expired today, meaning those who got in early on the IPO could begin to sell their shares. Yeah, no mega payday. Sorry, the stock was down more than 17%. Elsewhere in tech, Tesla, which reports profits tomorrow, slowed more than 4%. Google clicked down more than 2%. Home builders got nailed after new data on housing prices was weaker than expected. KB Home unloaded nearly 2.5%. Today, Lennar forfeited more than 1%. Ryland Group kissed off nearly 3%. Bonds rose, but just barely. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.59%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve is scheduled to release its monthly consumer credit report. The Senate Special Aging Committee discusses the fight against cancer. And the Dow Jones closed above 15,000 for the first time just 1 year ago. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. An observation now by way of setting up this next story. Social media can be a dangerous, dangerous place unless you know what you're doing. To wit, a former PayPal executive who mistakenly tweeted offensive statements about his coworkers, calling one a useless middle manager, not so bad, called another one, though, something far less family friendly. That executive is doubling down in a series of tweets that followed a weekend Twitter escapade gone horribly wrong. Rakesh Agrawal is threatening to make a former colleague's private text messages public. And so now the company in question, PayPal, is faced with the question of what to do when a former executive goes rogue on social media. Marketplace Noel King has the story.
Here are some of Agrawal's tweets to Stan.
Stan, I am really disappointed in you as an entrepreneur. You said we were going to change the world. Now you are being a corporate stooge.
Then Agrawal says he might escalate the situation.
If you don't stand up for me, I will start sharing your text messages to me. Do the right thing. Your move, Stan.
Sandra Crowe wrote a book about dealing with difficult people called Since Strangling Isn't an Option. She says social media presents real pitfalls for companies.
People who have a big need for power are going to be able to hold companies hostage.
Crowe says companies like PayPal can either ignore the tweets of an unhappy former employee like Agrawal or fight back.
I mean, these guys all know each other. You can make his reputation so bad in the tech world that nobody will want to hire him, do business with him, do deals with him, and maybe not even email him.
Shel Holtz, principal at Holtz Communication Plus Technology, has looked at Agrawal's tweets and thinks PayPal should ignore him.
Spelling and punctuation were all terrible. I think he's harming himself more than anybody else.
So, your move, PayPal. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Medicine is sometimes a money-losing proposition. Hospitals are under all kinds of financial pressures, none of them more so than hospitals in low-income or rural parts of the country. So what are they supposed to do at a time when their business model, it is fair to say, is being changed quite a bit? Well, how about this? If they really need to cut costs and save money, they might try giving their services away. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, Adam Ragusa explains.
32-year-old Layman Green is a caretaker for the developmentally disabled in Macon, Georgia. He's a cheerful guy, but he's got a cyst behind his ear.
It's been kind of giving me problems for the past few years.
How big is it?
It gets to about the size of a lemon when it gets infected.
You're kidding?
Yeah.
Most people would get something like that cut off pronto, but Green doesn't have insurance.
I actually am looking into the Obamacare now.
Though, because he lives in Georgia, where the governor has declined to expand Medicaid, there's a good chance Green makes too much money to qualify for Medicaid and not enough to get subsidized private insurance.
I'm going to give you some medicine to make you a bit more comfortable, okay?
Okay. And yet, here's Green in an operating room, drifting off into a chemically induced sleep.
Okay.
While the doctors cut that cyst away with an electronic knife. Green is one of the first people to come through Macon's new volunteer surgery clinic. It's called the SPIN program, Surgery for People in Need. The docs work on Sundays for free, while the facilities and diagnostics are donated by the Medical Center of Central Georgia. Roz McMillan is one of the hospital's vice presidents.
This is a way that we can support this program with patients that we would likely see anyway, that would be in our system because they have a need that hasn't been taken care of.
In other words, Layman Green's lemon-sized cyst was probably going to land him in the emergency room eventually. Since he's uninsured, the hospital would have ended up eating much of that cost. Cutting the thing off before it gets that bad is a much simpler procedure.
So by them just going ahead and donating it off the top, they are saving themselves thousands of dollars in the long run.
Laura Ebert runs a program called Surgery on Sunday in Lexington, Kentucky that started in 2005. This new free surgery program in Macon is a copy of Ebert's, literally.
We have something that, you know, we can provide on disk or zip drive that shows all the paperwork, you know, how to apply for tax-exempt status, how to apply for the federal malpractice program.
Using that template, free surgery clinics have also sprung up in Omaha and Dallas. Ebert predicts that list is going to grow as hospitals realize it's in their economic interest to help out. Low-income people in many states are getting insurance through an expanded Medicaid, but their deductible for an elective surgery could be as high as $10,000.
Hernias and gallbladders and things that we do on a regular basis are considered elective surgery, not life-threatening, so therefore they'll have to pay their deductible.
That means people are likely to put off their surgery. The problem gets worse, they end up in the ER, Medicaid reimbursements are low, so again, the hospital gets stuck eating some cost. As long as you got a doctor willing to donate her time, it might be cheaper to take out that gallbladder for free. In Macon, Georgia, I'm Adam Ragusea for Marketplace.
Your average rags-to-riches story doesn't often literally involve rags and riches, but it is, in fact, the story of Sofia Amoroso. She's the founder and CEO of Nasty Gal. It's an online clothing retailer for women, say, 20 to 30 years old or so. Her book about how she got where she is, from temp jobs and dumpster diving to building a really successful company, is called Girl Boss. Sofia, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder whether we ought to start with a bit of an origin story, because you were not always the high-powered company founder and CEO, were you? You had a different start in life, shall we say.
I did. I was always looking for my way and often bumping into things. In Girl Boss, I talk about throwing yourself against the wall the way you throw spaghetti against the wall to see if you stick to different things. And I did a lot of that at an early age. I thought I was destined to smash capitalism by
How's that
stealing...
going for you so far?
It didn't work.
Yeah.
And I'm glad it didn't.
But it was, you know, I mean, you were shoplifting and dumpster diving. It was the whole deal.
It was the whole deal. I thought I was going to, you know, escape the system by, I don't know, like committing petty theft from, you know, large big box retailers. And ultimately, it just, the joke was on me. So, I had to figure something else out.
And then, to make a long story short, you wind up selling clothing, vintage clothing, right, on eBay at the age of 22, 23.
So... I launched Nasty Gal Vintage in late 2006, selling just exclusively vintage clothing. It was probably maybe a dozen things a week. The auctions ran for 10 days and started at $9.99. You know, I took a lot of care in what I put in the store. At a certain point, I realized I was building a brand.
All right, so here comes the less than entirely sensitive question, though. Given the success that you've had in building a brand and a company that is debt-free and in the tens of millions of dollars, right, in revenue every year, I wonder whether, and I'm trying not to be pejorative when I say this, I wonder whether you've become the man, as it were.
I'm the woman.
Okay. Have you become the woman?
I think that's, yeah, I'm like my version of the woman. I'm not the man. You know, the man to me is what the world tells you to be. And, you know, if it's on your own terms, it's not, you're not succumbing to anything. It's you're taking what works for you, and you know, what exists in the world, cobbling it together and making a life for yourself. I think there's nothing wrong with that. But when you do it as a result of the world pressuring you to, then certainly you've quote unquote sold out or become the man. But for me, no, this is like an entirely different trip.
This book is, and just starting with the title, Girl Boss. It's about your experiences as a woman in this society and in the economy and now running this company, right? You're a founder and CEO who happens to be a woman. When I talk, though, to other female CEOs, they often don't want to talk about being a female CEO.
Yeah, I don't really talk about it that much, honestly, in Girl Boss. You know, I call it Girl Boss. I could have called it Boss. That might have been pretty boring. I happen to be a girl, so, and I put a hashtag in front of it. But
I really don't like talking about it. And I talk a lot in Girl Boss about, you know, that the best way of, you know, honoring the history of women's rights is just by making shit happen. And you're not going to, you know, you can change the world by talking about it. But ultimately, I believe the best way is just to do things.
Do you ever sit back and just go, this is just bananas, man. This is completely crazy.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm on NPR with Kai Ryssdal. It's bananas.
The book is called Girl Boss. It is by Sophia Amoruso. She is the founder and CEO of Nasty Gal. Sophia, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, which comes in the guise of what is officially known as a Form F-1 registration statement under the Securities Act of 1933, is what it says on the paper there. Alibaba Group Holding Limited, the Chinese e-commerce conglomerate, is the filer. Eagerly awaited, this IPO is probably an understatement here. The company is going to raise $1 billion when it goes to the markets, with more to come, surely. A market valuation possibly of as much as $150 or $200 billion. And here is just a hint as to why. Alibaba says it sells more stuff and thus generates more package deliveries every year than UPS does globally every year. So there you go. All right. And with that, we are done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off about 0.75%, 16,401. The NASDAQ down 1.33%. Hello, Twitter finished at 4,080. The S&P 500 reversed 0.8%, 1883 there. Nancy Fargali is our senior producer of special projects. Caitlin Esch works on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shay Huffman. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.